This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. These days, we're pretty good about our trash, right? We recycle, we don't litter, we might even sign up for the local park cleanup a couple of times a year. But after we sort it, tie it, and toss it, where does it go? When trash disappears from our lives, it doesn't leave the planet. So what does it really mean to throw something away? Margaret Morales and Phil Corrigan wanted to know where that away really was. They decided to trek across the country to find out. Margaret and Phil are documentarians for Finding Away, the trash blog. And they join the program now to tell us more about it. Welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, so I have this. Let's imagine I have this soda can in front of me here, and I finish the soda. Where does it go from there? Tell us about its life cycle after it leaves me.
So a soda can, depending on what you do with it, whether
you know
dump
I'll
it,
recycle because I'm in public radio.
So if you're a good person and you do recycle it, it's going to go probably to what's called a materials recycling facility or a MRF. And MRF is just a fun word to say, so I wanted to work that in. But once it goes there, they'll sort it out because you probably put it in a blue bin that has paper and glass and metal and all sorts of plastic. So they sort out the metal. And if it's a can of aluminum, it's going to end up being returned into an aluminum can again. It's a pretty simple cycle. I don't know a whole lot about the industrial process that does that, but most aluminum cans do get turned back into an aluminum can. There's a pretty good industry or market for aluminum, so no worries there.
And obviously, a relatively economical way to make this to recycle it.
Mm-hmm. Right? I think it's one of the materials, as opposed to glass or paper or plastic. It's one of the materials that ends up using the least amount of energy to be turned back into a useful product.
All right. Well, so Margaret, talk about the inspiration for this particular project. What was the mission?
Well, it started out because we were living. I was working here in North Carolina making little video projects, and Jeanette Stokes from the Resource Center for Women in Ministry in the South hired me to make a video with Bryant Holsenbeck, who's an artist here in Durham. And Bryant makes all of her art pieces out of trash, out of reclaimed materials, basically, and they're beautiful. They're usually animals. And so Bryant asked us the question, where is away? And that was many years ago now, like 2008. So that was the seed that germinated many years later into our project, finding what does that mean? Where is it when you throw something in the garbage can?
And so how did that evolve? What was the project? What did you do?
So we got to thinking this question of where is away. We started paying a little more attention to our own garbage. And I grew up in Washington State, kind of in the northwest corner of the state. And I went to the dump when I was little with my parents. You know, you tear out your carpet, you take it there or something like that. And that I always thought was the dump. It's in the county. It's this smelly, nasty, ugly place out away from most people. Turns out that's a transfer station. And that garbage, that all the garbage I made as I was growing up has been shipped to Oregon, like 350 miles from where I lived. And I had no idea about this. So as we thought about where is away, we realized that there's this culture of hiding from our garbage in the U.S. We don't want to look at it. We don't want to know anything about it. We want it to be magical. Like, I put it in this bin, the bin makes it vanish, and I don't have to think about it again. So it kind of came to us that we should really think about it. We should pay attention to the many different ways that garbage is going to be taken away. And that led to, let's do a road trip, but only look at garbage on the road trip. And let's go all over the country and talk to anyone who will talk to us about garbage.
And who were those people? Was this all then life in the landfill, or you know, what other kinds of folks did you talk with?
No, well, we visited some landfills, some MRFs, some incinerators, but we also talked to a lot of nonprofits that have different missions around trash, zero waste, or anti-incinerator groups. We talked to professors at universities who do research. One kind of big theme in our blog became organics. And we talked to companies or nonprofits that do composting. And we talked to people. There was actually an author here in Durham. His name is Jonathan Bloom. And we talked to him. He wrote a book called American Wasteland. And it's all about food waste in America. He's really neat. He's very interested in leftovers, which you think of as like such a small part of our waste problem. But actually, it's big. And it's kind of neat how he gets into it and
So what happens to most of it? What did you get into the percentages? How much is recycled and how much of what we recycle really gets turned into something else?
You know, we did. And, you know, cities love to publish what they call diversion percentages or recycling percentages. You know, a city will say, oh, we recycle 50% of our material. We found that those numbers are often messy numbers because you can count, say you burn your garbage and then you have a power plant on top of that incinerator and you're making you're making electricity out of it. You can count that in your number of, oh, that's recycled. But it's not really. It's burnt. It's still garbage you produced, and the only good thing that came out of it was that when you were destroying it, you managed to get a little energy.
Well, isn't that is the point. I mean, nothing is, you know, matter is neither created nor destroyed. So all we're doing is in constant conversion process, right? And isn't it a good idea to take what we threw away,
but
turn it into electricity?
There's efficient ways of doing it, and there's inefficient ways of doing it, I think. And I think a lot of times the way we look at our garbage are very inefficient ways. And it goes back to maybe if you just didn't produce some of that stuff in the first place, you could actually save a ton of energy. But burning garbage, especially if it's got organics in it, is not very efficient because organics are mostly water. You know, food is highly filled with water. And so when you burn that, it doesn't burn well. You need gas, you need plastics, you need oil-based things to really get it going. So it's not an efficient process in my mind.
And at a landfill, tell us about what's really going on there at the landfill and where do we find these things?
What's going on at the landfill?
Yeah.
Well, a lot's going on, I guess. They're taking your trash and they're smashing it there, so it will never be useful, quote-unquote, because everything's destroyed. One thing that I really got into was this idea of landfill gas recovery, which is when you have the organics and they go to the landfill, they'll off-gas methane. And it's become very in vogue now. Well, I mean, it's mandated that landfills now put in a gas recovery system so they get that methane, and then they are using it to produce energy. So again, it's something in our trash system that we're thinking, oh, this is renewable, this is so great. When, as a matter of fact, that's not the most efficient way to get the gas. You're not really collecting most of it, and it's just another way that you don't have to be involved in where your trash goes. You can just throw it out, and you don't really know what happens, and it's...
Well, one of the things that happens that you discovered, and I think maybe some of us know, is that it gets exported. And if there's an export, there has to be an importer. So I don't know if you know this, but here in the state of North Carolina, we've just degraded our environmental quality standards to allow lower restrictions on landfills and the trucks that bring them. Mm-hmm. And so you would ask, well, why would you want to encourage trash and degrade your environmental protection that protects health and safety? And the answer is because it's an economic engine. It brings in revenue and it produces jobs. That was our answer. So the first question is, how does a landfill produce revenue and this trash importation? How much of it goes on and is it a big job generator?
I think that, you know, a landfill does have jobs. You got the guy at the gate. You have people who run the trucks. But it does not take a lot of people to run a landfill. It's a process that has been advanced to where we got it down. We know how to do landfills, at least the way we're doing them. That doesn't necessarily mean they're a good thing, but we know how to do it. We know what we're doing. It's simple. And then also, when you're importing garbage, you're going to get the tipping fee because that's all you're doing is you're saying, hey, other people in the world, you can put your garbage here and pay me some money for it. So you make that money. Oftentimes, you also make what's called a host fee, where whoever wanted to site the landfill in that locality in the first place agrees to pay you a percentage of their profit, essentially, so that you do get revenue. There's no doubt about that. If you were to put a recycling plant instead of a landfill, you're going to hire more people. That's for sure. I don't know if you'd end up getting more revenue out of the sales of the material because recycling markets are very tricky. But you would definitely create more jobs if you had a recycling plant than if you had a landfill, if you just compared them one-to-one.
So are there places where states or regions where are net importers and why?
Yeah, we really found there's a big trend right now. The South and the Midwest have the lowest tipping fees and the largest capacity for how many tons they can receive a year. So they're trying to encourage business basically in the states for other states like in the Northeast. Northeast has really high tipping fees to export their garbage to those regions.
And we talk about it regionally and state by state, but when it comes down to the actual placement of the landfill, we find that there is a real correlation between poverty, right, color, yeah, race, and where those landfills are.
It's true. And we visited quite a few kind of capped landfills because they're easier to visit than in a landfill that's still operating. We visited one in New Orleans in the 9th Ward that was called the Agriculture Street Landfill, and it had been turned into a housing project back in the 70s, and then it got turned into a Superfund site, and that was in the 80s. And then Hurricane Katrina came along and kind of it made it a moot point because nobody lives there now. But oftentimes when we place a landfill near a low-income community, once that landfill is finished, people are going to want to use the land. And so then you get housing built on it or you get a park put on it. And it's not always a great idea to have people living on the stuff that we've been burying there.
What about living near? Is there much of a danger from living near the place before you cap it and put houses on it?
Yeah, well, I think one of the most powerful stories for me that we did was in California. And we went to this tiny town called Gonzales in the middle of California. It's most of the population is Latino and speaks Spanish. And they had been cited to have an incinerator put in their community. And they produce a tiny amount of the trash that would end up at the incinerator. And they were trying to fight to get it to go away because, yes, there are emissions that come from incineration. And that's a very complicated topic, but everybody can agree there are emissions. We met with two women who had kind of taken the lead on a community effort to try and fight the placement of the incinerator. And it was amazing to me what underdogs they were, I think, in terms of their resources to fight a huge company. They are moms. They have full-time jobs. They are some of the only people in the community that were bilingual. And they're fighting a multi-million dollar company.
With support in terms of public officials, whatever level this is being decided, if they've got a lot of money, they got friends on their side who've been elected to office, I guess.
The company.
Am I right?
Oh,
yeah, the city council was very in favor of this.
All right, and you've only gotten one representative from that particular district, if
exactly.
at all. And sometimes they're unincorporated areas as well, so then you have no representation effectively. And also this correlates to something you found out about the BP oil spill, which was part of your project. Tell us about that.
That was an interesting one, too. So after the BP oil spill, something it was talked about, but it wasn't the headline news, was all of the solid waste coming from the spill. And a lot of that was the boom that was used to contain the oil and things like that, balls of tar. So this garbage was sent to 9 different landfills in the Gulf. And if you look at the population of residents on the Gulf of Mexico, it's like who are people of color, African-American, it's like 25 or 23%. And yet the landfills that were chosen of where the garbage went had disproportionately high populations of African Americans. So that number itself is partially reflective of the fact that the landfills in the first place were in those communities.
And then it spreads because if you have a particularly toxic spill or waste, then that's where it's going to go where the existing landfills are. So that's where they are. So, Phil, the Florida Keys, I guess, tell us about that. That's an interesting story. The Florida Keys, kind of mostly at sea level, mostly 20 feet, right? Tell us the story.
So we designed our trip so that we'd kind of get to all the different extremities of the country, barring Alaska and Hawaii. So when we were in Florida, we decided we got to go out to the Keys to see what's going on with garbage out there. And as we were driving out, I'd never been before. It's pretty impressive how flat it is. This is not a place that's very high. And when we get there, I had heard about a landfill. It was closed, but we wanted to visit it. It's in an island right next to Key West, like literally, 100 yards from Key West. We go there. This landfill is they always strike me as very impressive. They're big mounds. But being from Washington, big mounds next to bigger mountains don't look very big. Big mounds on the Florida Keys look like gigantic mountains. It was amazing. So we go up to this thing and it's just looming and huge and covered in grass. And I thought, man, I didn't know that, the highest point on the Florida Keys was a pile of garbage. So I started to do some research and I found out that nobody actually considers that the high point. even though it's, I mean, it's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
It's, for all intents and purposes, a part of the geography. Nobody counts it. So the highest point that I could find listed was 20 feet, and this landfill is about 70 feet tall. So it's another way that we hide from our garbage. We put it there. We mound it up, and then we act like it doesn't exist.
Well, tell us then again about this virtuous feeling along those lines that we get when we recycle. We throw everything in one, perhaps in one bin, and all of us are vaguely suspicious that it's going to end up buried anyway. What's the sorting process? How much of it? I think we touched on it earlier, but maybe
a little bit.
Go into some detail into what happens to the glass and the paper and the aluminum and all the rest.
This was something that we both were kind of interested in and startled to discover that – there's two types of recycling that go on in the U.S., or at least collection-wise. You can put it all in one bin, and that's called single stream. Or you can put it in several bins. You know, the people in the houses or the people in the offices can separate their materials, and that's called dual stream or multi-stream. The trend we've seen is towards single stream. Like, most municipalities are saying, hey, we're going to save on collection if we just put it all in one bin and compact it in a truck and have one truck to pick it all up. So as people are going more towards that, we went to several material recycling facilities, MRFs, where they said, hey, this stuff is more difficult to separate out when it's all sorts of stuff in there. And the more pure of a material you can get as far as a recycler is concerned, the more it's going to be worth. So if you can get pure, clear glass or pure white, you know, office-grade paper, that's going to be something they can sell for a higher price. When it's all mixed together, we don't have the technology yet to necessarily separate out all the things we want. Like when glass gets broken, the shards get in with the paper, and as far as the people we spoke to, they don't have any way of getting that out.
What do they do with it? Do they throw it away?
No, they sell it to like someone usually overseas who will turn it into like really low grade cardboard or packing paper. But then that stuff's never going to be recycled because as the fibers get broken down, they can't come back to be really long fiber, nice paper.
So I guess the answer is using waste reduction, just throwing out less, right? Anybody doing that? And any great thoughts and experiments?
Yeah, I think Margaret has a few.
Yeah, well, we came across, I guess, a wide variety of people doing that in different ways. We came across a company called Adhesive Clothing. And the designer of these beautiful dresses, she goes every week to like the Goodwill and stuff and buys scarves for 20 cents out of the bin and then creates dresses out of them. So, and her idea also, she introduced me to the idea of fast fashion, which is most clothes now that you buy at like a big chain are fast fashion. So they're made quickly and they're made cheaply and you're not meant to wear them for a long time. You want to get up with the new fashion pretty quickly. And so she's making clothes that are made to last. So that's a way of reducing.
Throw out less. Well, so has your elevated trash consciousness led you to other new practices now?
Oh, you know, we realize that we're just really bad with garbage. On our trip especially, because we're traveling, it was amazing. I think we just felt really guilty most of the time. we've seen some things that we want to do, though. You know, composting is – for sure, the easiest way to reduce the amount of food or garbage that you're putting in the landfill. And it's going to become something you can use. You know, it's good soil. You can put it in a pot and grow things out of it. So we're definitely going to compost.
And there's more compostable packing material now these days.
Oh, now you're it's getting complicated issue. Questions oh,
I think,
here.
You know, I
some
think
good, some bad.
What we've learned more than
30
anything
seconds I've got left. Go ahead.
Is that it's really complex. And so not everything that is compostable is actually compostable.
Right. And it may take more energy to make that than it would have been to, well, for another program. We'll have you back. Margaret Morales, Phil Corrigan, Documentarians, Finding a Way, The Trash Blog. You can find out more at thetrashblog.com. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we'll listen to the sounds of World War II. Stay tuned.